Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Hi, I'm Andrew McDermott. Are life and the universe a product of the blind outworking of laws governing cosmic, chemical, and biological evolution? Or is there more to the story? Today, we're looking again at a new book from Discovery Institute Press called Evolution and Intelligent Design in a Nutshell. It looks at the latest scientific evidence, from the smallest cell to the farthest reaches of the universe, to reveal the full story of life's origin and development. On this episode, I'm joined for part two of a discussion with one of the co-authors of this new book, Eric Anderson. Welcome back, Eric.
Thank you, Andrew. Glad to be back.
Today I wanted to focus on your second chapter, and this one really breaks some new ground. Your first chapter focused on the information problem. Your second chapter, which is chapter 3 in the book, focuses on the problem of creating a self-replicating entity. We discussed this in the prior podcast a little, but can you just briefly recap, what does a self-replicating entity have to do with the origin of life problem?
Sure. As we talked about previously, getting a living cell, the first living organism to arise by chance on the early Earth, isn't going to happen by chance. And even the most ardent materialists accept that fact. And so the idea is if we can just get some kind of a simpler self-replicator, then that can be used to build the first cell. You can't have Darwinian evolution until you have a self-replicating entity. And so the idea now in current origin of life research is to say if we could get a simple self-replicator, maybe even a single molecule, a self-replicating molecule on the early Earth, then Darwinian evolution can kick in. And then Darwinian evolution can be relied upon to go ahead and build the first living organism on the early Earth. So that's why it's very central. And a lot of people are under the misimpression that origin of life and Darwinian evolution are separate things. In fact, Darwinian evolution is not only relevant to the origin of life, it's absolutely central to the way that current origin of life researchers are approaching the problem.
Right. It's how they're trying to explain the origin of life, isn't it?
Exactly. You get a little self-replicator, and then hopefully Darwinian evolution will do the rest and help build the living organism.
Well, there have been a lot of criticisms of abiogenesis over the years, many of which have been pulled together in a wonderful and detailed book, The Mystery of Life's Origin, that we recently published. Why do we need another criticism of abiogenesis? And what does your argument contribute to the analysis of naturalistic origin of life scenarios?
There have been a lot of criticisms of abiogenesis over the years, and they continue to be made. They need to continue to be made. We need to continue to push them forward. A lot of them, however, are probabilistic in nature. And what I mean by that is often you will hear things like, well, what are the odds of getting a particular protein to arise by chance on the early Earth? Or what are the odds of a particular RNA polynucleotide, an RNA strand, to arise on the early Earth? And you can run some fairly straightforward mathematical analyses and come up with numbers there. Again, those are good arguments. They need to continue to be made. What I'm trying to do is bring to the fore another class of arguments that are not probabilistic in nature. Now, mathematicians could probably turn any argument into a probability of sorts, but at its heart, the argument that I'm making is not probabilistic, it's practical. And it relates to the engineering realities that are involved in getting a self-replicating entity. So let me give you an example. Let's suppose that you are a wealthy investor, and I come to you and I say, look, I've got an idea for perpetual motion, and I'd like you to give me $100 million so I can go off and build this perpetual motion machine, and I'll give you half of the proceeds that we get from this machine. What's your response to that? And we're not talking about something that is just rare or hard to do. We're talking about perpetual motion. And so if you know something about physics, most people would respond and say, not going to happen. And even if I said, look, it's a hard problem. I know we're trying really hard. We've got a lot of great ideas. We just need more time. We just need more funding. You're still not going to invest because you know not just that it's a hard problem. You know that it's not going to happen. Yeah. Because there is something that is preventing it. And so, you know, I apologize for getting a little bit technical here, but a lot of the origin of life arguments, even though they're great arguments, they assume something in the very argument. What they're assuming is that the origin of life through purely natural means, abiogenesis, is a non-zero probability. Might be super unlikely, might be incredibly against the odds, but the argument kind of assumes that it could still happen. What I'm saying is there may be principles, there are principles, I argue, that actually prevent this from happening from a fundamental standpoint of chemistry and physics and how we understand that those work and the engineering principles involved. And so what I'm hoping to do is if I come to you and convince you that the origin of life is like a lottery, and a really bad lottery and very hard to win with super bad odds, you might still have in the back of your mind, yeah, but perhaps it's possible. You know, there's still that little bit of a chance somewhere in the back of your mind. On the other hand, if I can come to you and convince you that origin of life is like perpetual motion, then hopefully you'll say, oh, well, that's not going to work. And so that's part of what I'm trying to do here. And then lastly, I would say it's really important for us to remember how this all plays out in the mind of the abiogenesis researcher, in the mind of the materialist. Self-replication is the key. Not information, not complex cellular machinery, not any of that stuff. Self-replication is the key because in their mind, once you have that self-replicator, Darwinian evolution kicks in and builds all the rest. And I'm not saying that's accurate. Let me be very clear, but that's the mentality. And if you're going to understand what's going on in the origin of life research area, you have to understand that mentality. And that's why self-replication is really the heart of the issue and what I call in the book the holy grail of this entire issue.
Eric, what is your assessment of the picture of the early Earth environment painted by Charles Darwin and Richard Dawkins, and how does that impact our understanding of abiogenesis?
Oh, this is a great question. So everybody, I think, recognizes, probably most of our listeners are aware, that when Darwin wrote his book in 1859, The Origin of Species, his great classic, he did not address the origin of life in that book. He simply assumed, okay, if we start with the living organism, what's going to happen next? How is it going to evolve? But he was interested in the topic of origin of life. And what was it, 12 years later in 1871, he sends this famous letter to his colleague, Joseph Hooker, and says, what if in some warm little pond we had various chemicals that could come together and start life? And that's where we get the term warm little pond from, is from this letter. Now, fast forward 104 years to the 1970s, when Richard Dawkins is writing his well-known book, The Selfish Gene, and he paints a very, very similar picture. And part of what he's arguing is that in today's environment, the reason we don't see living organisms arising from non-living matter is that they would be outcompeted in the current biosphere. But if we go back to the early Earth, and this is his word, not mine, they could drift unmolested through the thickening broth, is the way that he describes this. And so there's this sentiment that today, it's tough for, you know, non-living matter to turn into a living organism. But back on the early Earth, things were better. This was a kinder, gentler place for a first living organism to arise, or the first self-replicating entity. The problem with this view, well, there's multiple problems. One is this whole idea of this, you know, you can imagine this self-replicating molecule drifting unmolested through the thickening broth, as he describes
it. Such great prose.
It is. It's a wonderful story. It's very visually captivating. But why would we think that that makes any sense? We have this chemical soup, if you want to use that term, or hot dilute soup, as Haldane called it, or the warm little pond, as Darwin called it. And you've got these chemicals that are bumping into each other, reacting. And when the first self-replicator arises, all of the other molecules just sort of say, okay, back off. He's on an important mission. We're going to let him drift unmolested through the thickening broth so he can do his thing. I mean, it's just ridiculous. The problem of interfering cross-reactions is a massive problem for origin of life, and it's recognized as being just a huge problem. And if you add to that the twin problem of breakdown, then you have a real serious issue. Jim Tuer talks about this in some of his presentations. If you look at what the lifespan is of an RNA molecule, and we unfortunately right now in this current crisis are fighting an RNA-based system with COVID, but if you look at the lifetime of these RNA strands, it is not great. I mean, we're talking about something that is measured in days at most, and in many cases, in with an unprotected RNA strand, you're talking about hours or minutes. And so, again, just for our listeners, you know, picture the scene where we've waited for millions of years for this remarkable molecule, as Dawkins calls it, to arise. And suddenly we get to that point, and then within a few hours or a day or two, it's gone. We have to start over. And so these two twin problems of interfering cross-reactions and natural breakdown are just absolutely devastating to any origin of life scenario. And the idea that Darwin put forward, which is repeated by Dawkins almost verbatim, that, you know, the early Earth was somehow a benign and helpful environment within which this little self-replicating entity could get going, it's just ridiculous. I mean, it's just against the scientific evidence.
Well, in your second chapter in this book, to give us a better feel for self-replication, you walk us through what's required using 3D printers as an example. Now, they're actually trying to build self-replicating 3D printers. First, have they made any headway at all on this, and how close are they?
Well, you know, if you read the news or you read the information and the blogs that comes out from some of these folks, you'd think that they've got it almost solved. There are a couple of companies that have put out statements. The first self-replicating 3D printer, you know, buy it here. But unfortunately, when you look at the facts, it's really not the case. I mean, we are just light years away from creating anything that's self-replicating. And I walk through this in detail in the book and go through the analysis. But look, there's lots of creative engineering that's going on. 3D printing has set us on the first realistic path of having even an inkling of being able to accomplish this, but we're not even in the ballpark yet. We are so far away from having a self-replicating 3D printer, notwithstanding what you sometimes see in the headlines.
Now, I don't want to give too much away here. I want folks to go out and buy the book and read this amazing chapter, but in a nutshell, what's the take home from analyzing what all the 3D printers can do and if they can replicate themselves ad infinitum?
Yeah, so part of the point here is that when we look at a macro system like a 3D printer, and the reason I use that in the book is that it's very hard for most of us to get our arms around, you know, RNA molecules and that kind of thing. What would a self-replicating molecular system look like? But we can appreciate a little bit more a macro system like a 3D printer. So that's why I use that as an example. But when you analyze the requirements, you realize that this is an incredible engineering challenge. And it's not just that we need more imagination or we need more funding or we need more belief in ourselves to be able to accomplish this. This is only going to be accomplished through a tremendous amount of very sophisticated and detailed engineering. And so to think that something like a self-replicating molecule on the early Earth could accomplish this task is just, you know, it's just against the weight of the evidence, and it's just storytelling, frankly.
Yeah. Well, listeners, if you are tuned in here and haven't bought the book, you do need to know that the real fun is in Eric walking readers through all these things that would be required of a truly self-replicating 3D printer. And then he applies all that to the origin of life problem. It's great stuff. The book is available online at Amazon and BN.com. And if you purchase the book via Amazon, consider writing a review there to help others take the plunge and follow this scientific evidence where it's leading. Eric, thanks so much for your time and your expertise on this topic here.
This is a pleasure, Andrew. Thank you.
You can enjoy more episodes of ID the Future at idthefuture.com or anywhere podcasts are heard. For the show, I'm Andrew McDermott. Thanks so much for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.